At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Ladies and gentlemen, allow me to introduce Fed Chair Jay Powell.
I have a brief statement, and then I'll be happy to respond to your questions.
First time down the chute for the new guy? How'd he do, huh? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday, today, the 21st of March. Good as always to have you here, everybody. The new guy on the monetary policy block had his first press conference today. Jay Powell has been in the big chair 6, maybe 7 weeks by now. And really, job number one today for him was to not upset the economic apple cart. He didn't, and the economic news helped.
The committee's estimates of growth went up. The committee's estimates of unemployment went down. And there was a very slight increase in inflation.
All of which, obviously, are good things. Powell did caution, though, as well, not to try to read too terribly far between the economic lines.
You know, we made one decision at this meeting, and that decision was to raise the federal funds rate by 25 basis points.
All right, the news. The news. The Fed short-term interest rate, technically called the federal funds rate, went up 0.25%. That is layman speak for 25 basis points. To sit now in a range of 1.5% to 1.75%. Still low by historical standards. There were some other kinds of questions today asked as well. Interesting ones. The big picture impact of tariffs, for instance.
A number of participants in this FOMC did bring up the issue of tariffs. And if I could summarize what came out of that, it was first that there's no thought, I think, that changes in trade policy should have any effect on the current outlook. Second thing is, I would say, is that a number of participants reported in about their conversations with business leaders around the country and reported that trade policy has become a concern going forward.
Those tariffs, by the way, 25% on steel and 10% on aluminum, go into effect on Friday. Also, Chair Powell was asked about the tax bill, of which he said, and this is his word, the economic impact is uncertain. So all in all, a basically steady as she goes performance from the new Fed chair. Mark Zuckerberg resurfaced this afternoon. The CEO of Facebook, of course, in a post on Facebook, made his first public comment since the news broke last weekend that Cambridge Analytica had scraped data from 50 million Facebook users and used it in questionable ways. We got Molly Wood, the host of Marketplace Tech, on the phone to make me smart on all of this. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
So this was, it was a longish post by Zuckerberg. He laid out a chronology and he said what the company is going to do, some investigations. What do you think is going to change now?
Yeah, you know, it's very interesting because the tone of this post is essentially the tone of all of the Mark Zuckerberg sort of apology posts, if you go back through time. There are some changes, and I think they're important. Fundamentally, this story is not just about how much access Facebook has to your data. It's who else has access. And that is mainly third-party applications that either you install or you do that login with Facebook thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then those apps get access to all your data. Now, in the early days, part of the way that Facebook got so big so fast is that it got all these developers onto the platform so you could play fun games and take fun quizzes. And the way it got those developers on the platform was to give them access to an all-you-can-eat buffet of data
right
about all of us. That is how Cambridge Analytica got all those profiles. Facebook restricted that access around 2014. And today, Mark Zuckerberg said that that access will be restricted even further. They'll take a look back at apps and how much data they gathered then and let people know that is likely to be horrifying, the results of that.
Yeah.
And they will give users more obvious control over what apps can access our data.
Which is no small thing, because Facebook privacy and security settings are notoriously buried deep in those menus. Is this going to help, though?
I think that that is a really open question. In Facebook's previous history, you know, this has been enough. Sort of a vague apology and then some relatively substantive changes that don't do much to impact the business model.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that as this goes forward, this is the point where people are going to realize, hey, wait, this is the business model. And it always has been. And the extent of that will become increasingly clear. And I think that's just going to be an ongoing PR issue.
Okay, but here's the deal. Data is money. And so Zuckerberg is now saying, in essence, we're going to take a hit, perhaps, because we're going to limit data. Is that what this is going to lead to?
I find that hard to believe.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's sort of the pitch here is, you know, for example, if you haven't used an app in over 3 months, we'll turn off access
right.
to your data. But there's no kind of... There's not a broad acknowledgement that this is the business model and that it fundamentally is going to change. And I think that it's also safe to say that Zuckerberg and Facebook executives are betting on a lot of people not making these changes and continuing to use Facebook the way they always have, because not only is it, as many people refer, you know, say the oil of the modern economy,
right.
It's everything. It's everything to Facebook. And increasingly, I think now we realize it's everything to all the apps that you use on Facebook as well.
Right. And we're going to have a story from Amy Scott here in a minute about what Facebook is to businesses. But in the 30-ish or so seconds that you and I have left, do you think this is a tipping point? Do you think Zuckerberg now understands what's going on? And you know, it's really funny. As I asked that question, I realized I've asked you that question every single time Facebook gets into
exactly.
trouble. Right? I mean, what
exactly.
do you think?
Congress wants answers. The European Union wants answers. The FTC may be investigating these privacy violations. I do think that this is different. I do not think Mark Zuckerberg thinks it's different.
Molly Wood is the host of Marketplace Tech, also with me of a podcast we do called Make Me Smart, where we talked in the most recent episode, which dropped yesterday. We talked at length about this whole thing. More from Molly on that. Make Me Smart, wherever you get your podcast. Molly, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
So as I said, the quick answer to the whole Facebook thing for a whole lot of people is that users should just delete their accounts, right? And we have seen that approach work before. Delete Uber is what I'm thinking of, which is easy when Lyft is basically the next app over, right? Just a thumb smash away. But for Facebook's 2 billion some odd users, there is nothing quite like it yet. Marketplace's Amy Scott has that one.
Like a lot of people, Jody Marvel had been using Facebook less recently to escape the social media bubble. She's a math and economics tutor in Boise, Idaho. Then she read about Cambridge Analytica.
And I was just really shocked and angry.
So this morning, Marvel downloaded all of her posts and pictures and deleted her account.
I want to send them a message just telling them that this is not acceptable. To me.
Stefan Matanovitz, a lawyer in Philadelphia, quit Facebook a month ago after advising his clients to steer clear of it. He plans to delete Facebook-owned Instagram next.
Ultimately, it came down to, am I going to eat my own dog food? And the answer for me was yes.
That might mean missing out on invitations or local events. Many others say Facebook is too important for their business or for staying in touch with distant relatives. Cheryl Katzen, a librarian in D.C., is torn. When Hurricane Harvey flooded Houston last summer, a message she posted on Facebook led to the rescue of her elderly parents.
It's moments like that where if I could have kissed Mark Zuckerberg, I would have.
Alessandro Acquisti studies the economics of privacy at Carnegie Mellon. He says when you delete Facebook, you're not just deleting your profile.
You're also saying goodbye to all the accumulated value you derive from interacting with other people on the network.
Jody Marvel, who quit Facebook this morning, hopes if enough people join her, a viable and more responsible alternative will take its place. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Facebook shares actually bounced back a little bit today, about 0.75%. Elsewise, in the wider markets, traders were of mixed minds after the Fed meeting. We will have the details when we do the numbers. In Tempe, Arizona this past weekend, a self-driving Uber in autonomous mode but with a man behind the wheel hit and killed a woman crossing the street. Almost immediately, the company pulled all of its self-driving cars off the road in Arizona, San Francisco, Toronto, and in Uber's home base of Pittsburgh as well. That city has rolled out the red carpet for companies like Uber and others on the edge of technology. So we wanted to see how the news was going over. From WESA in Pittsburgh, Marketplace's Erica Barris reports.
On any given day, there are self-driving cars from five different companies on the streets here. Jackie Erickson is with the Pittsburgh Robotics Network. She says the robotics industry has changed the city, not only by boosting its economy with jobs and investment, but
it allows everybody to take some pride in a city that has struggled. And now we actually have a coolness factor.
Missy Cummings is an autonomy engineer at Duke University. She gets why Pittsburgh has bent over backwards for tech companies who have set up shop here.
I think when a city does do that, they do see an infusion of young top talent come into their city.
But she says cities may also be a little too quick to let these young industries use their streets as laboratories.
The technology is not ready.
Eric Bohr is with Bike Pittsburgh, an advocacy group. Last year, it surveyed residents on how they feel about self-driving cars. Most said the cars were more respectful than those with human drivers. Still, there were some complaints.
The autonomous vehicles weren't always passing bicyclists with the legal 4 feet, for instance. It wasn't clear that autonomous vehicles were always yielding to pedestrians in crosswalks.
Mike Wagner's been developing vision and safety systems for all sorts of autonomous vehicles for years. And surprise, robots are different from you and me.
You know, when we're talking about autonomous robots out there in the real world, then unexpected things are kind of bound to happen.
Even so, Jackie Erickson with the Pittsburgh Robotics Network says news of the Uber fatality in Arizona,
it sent a shockwave through most of the industry.
It's too soon to know whether the accident will lead to greater regulation of autonomous cars or make cities think harder about allowing them. But in Pittsburgh, the experiment keeps rolling along. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Coming up, you know, we're the United States. We'll figure out how to solve this crisis, and then you're going to be left with this whole vast array of other economic problems.
Well, that's great, huh? Hank Paulson, Ben Bernanke, and Tim Geithner, and the regrets they have 10 years on. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is off 44 points today, a tenth of 1%, 24,682. The NASDAQ down 19 points, about a quarter percent. 73.45. The S&P 500 slipped 5 points, about a tenth percent, 27.11. As we mentioned, the Fed is raising its benchmark short-term interest rate by a quarter point, 25 basis points, if you want to get snooty-tooty about it. Banks make money on interest. So over at the ATM line, Citigroup deposited a half percent. J.P. Morgan Chase stayed about the same. On the consumer credit card front, Visa chipped off 1.3%. Today, American Express declined about two-tenths of 1%. Bonds fell, yield on the 10-year T-note at 2.88%. Today, you're listening to Marketplace. You go first this time.
Hey, I'm Molly Wood.
And I'm Kai Rizdahl.
Our podcast, Make Me Smart, is back, and we are exploring something you need to succeed in business, politics, you know, basically everywhere.
It is the art, the lost art, some might say, of compromise.
Yeah, because this country is not going to get where it needs to go. Frankly, you and your boss are not going to get where you need to go if you cannot even get people in the room.
We're not doing the room.
The
right
room
now.
We're not. How come we can't? Can we just compromise on this one issue?
No.
Just sing like a little bit?
No. Check us out at makemesmart.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by public investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with public investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither public investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We've been spending a whole lot of time this week on a conversation I had the other day with the three people who were, for want really of a better term, the government's first responders when the financial crisis really started to break 10 years ago. Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Fed back then, Hank Paulson, Secretary of the Treasury, and Tim Geithner, then the president of the New York Fed. We got up to Lehman Brothers weekend yesterday, September of 2008, and TARP, the Troubled Asset Relief Program, and the difficulty they had managing the crisis and the politics at the same time.
It's not the best way to run a country, run a financial system, which is to require politicians to decide in the moment that they need a stronger fire station.
Today, what the three wish maybe they had done differently.
What are your regrets? What did you do that maybe hasn't worked out 10 years later like you thought it would, Tim?
Well, I think the three big things, there's many of them, but I think three big things are we as a country allowed the financial system to outgrow the protections we put in place after the Great Depression and leave ourselves on the eve of the crisis with a very fragile, dangerous system. The second thing is that we went into the crisis, we've said, with very weak tools for protecting the country from a panic. It took a long time and it took too long and it took too much damage to remedy that failure. And although with that authority, you know, we did a set of very innovative, very powerful things, and I think produced dramatically better results than is true for most countries caught up in financial crises, you know, we were still left with a terribly damaged economy, deep scars, huge loss of confidence in public institutions. The country got caught up in a little fever of austerity too prematurely.
Fever of austerity.
Yeah, and we took the...
Yep, went through that.
We put on the brakes a little too early. You know, these things take a long time to come out of and to repair. Recoveries after financial crises are very slow and weak and fragile. You need to err on the side of doing more longer than you think if you're going to improve the odds of getting back to some better place. You know, we put our foot on the brakes a little too early.
Hank, regrets? Things that maybe you look back and you're like, that was an unintended consequence.
Yeah, why? I can be pretty self-critical, so I can think of all kinds of things I'd said I wish I'd said differently, but the biggest regret I've got is that the life is going to be much more difficult for any regulators sitting in the seats facing another crisis because what we did was so unpopular. As tough as it was during the crisis, in the crisis, you know, you're playing offense, and so you're really a lot of time to be scared or to feel sorry for yourself. But I remember, you know, after the crisis, you know, all the criticism and then seeing, I don't know how I read the poll right, but there was a poll that came out. And as I read it, the TARP was more, you know, less popular than torture. And so I looked at it and said, we'd worked so hard. We had done something that had pulled the country back, I think, from the abyss. But I realize you're never going to get credit for, you know, preventing a crisis that people don't see. And the fact that we never were able to, and I never was able to make the connection between what it is this financial system does for the average American. And if the system doesn't work, how that's going to impact the average American, and that we weren't doing this for Wall Street. And so that's, to me, my biggest regret by far.
Ben?
Well, I didn't foresee the panic. I mean, I didn't appreciate that the problems in the mortgage market, the subprime market, were going to cause a loss of confidence in the broad financial system and lead to a panic. Now, I think if I had foreseen it, I would have had more credibility, but I don't think I could have, you know, materially averted what actually happened. I think in terms of things that I could have done differently, I agree with Hank that, you know, we were so focused. I remember trying to deal with some of these situations. It felt like a one-armed juggler with so many balls in the air and trying to focus on my daily tasks and the challenges. Again, the communication, trying to help people understand against their instincts that, you know, allowing the banking system to collapse was not going to be something that would be irrelevant to their lives, that it was going to have an effect on jobs, on mortgages, on incomes in a really big way. You know, I don't know. I made efforts. I went on television. I went on 60 Minutes. Yeah. And I did various things to try to explain why we were doing what we were doing and how I, as an academic, you know, had no particular connection to Wall Street, for example. But obviously, we didn't make that case, and it was difficult.
Did this episode, and I'd like to actually get all three of you to answer this one individually, did this change the way you think about this country, this economy at all, how we've changed in the past 10 years?
I was going to say, I think, you know, this is a dark thing and did just terrible damage. But we were in many ways a really lucky country because we went into this with a lot of financial resources, certainly large enough to deal with the problem. Even though it took place at this really dangerous political transition between two administrations of different parties, we had two presidents who were overwhelmingly focused on like trying to figure out how to do the right thing and not to exploit it for political advantage against the other. And, you know, we were very lucky in our colleagues. You know, we had a tremendously talented group of people who were trusted each other and willing to debate everything and go right at the hard stuff. I love Hank's story, which is, you know, my general approach to life is you see something hard, you run at it, not away from it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we tried to honor that basic strategy. And we were lucky to have those strengths as a country.
But did it change how you think about this economy?
I remember having a conversation with President Obama before the election, mm-hmm. when I first met him. I never met him before. And he said to me at one point, I might need to ask you to come to Washington and work for me. And I said, you shouldn't do that. That'd be a mistake. And I had a long list of reasons why that was the case. But one thing I said to him was that, you know, we're the United States. We'll figure out how to solve this crisis. And then you're going to be left with this whole vast array of other economic problems that are not my life's work. You need other people for those things. With the crisis behind us now, mm-hmm. at least the financial crisis behind us, and a set of reforms that should make the system safer over time, we're back to confronting the damage caused by a, you know, deeply powerful set of long forces that were eroding the quality of life for the average American. You know, no income growth, huge rise in inequality, deep anxiety about the future in that context. And I think the crisis made those things seem worse. But you're now finding people, I think, more open to trying to understand those and trying to think about what you do about them.
Same question to you, which is, did this change the way you think about the economy?
Well, before the crisis, I think there was at least some tendency to think that financial panics were something that happened in emerging markets or in grainy black and white, you know, films of people lining up in front of banks in the 1930s, and we found out we can have a big financial crisis even in an advanced economy. Of course, this was a global crisis. It wasn't just the United States. Europe was also very badly hit. So that was certainly something we learned, although at some level we understood that. To reiterate, I think that part of the reason this was so damaging both economically and politically was because it came on top of some very disturbing trends. I gave a speech at the European Central Bank's annual conference last summer called When Growth Is Not Enough and pointed out that even with overall growth in GDP, that with median income, median wages not growing very fast, with inequality rising, with social mobility being more limited, that a lot of people are feeling pretty unhappy with the way the economy is going. And on top of that, we now get this very bad recession and the crisis. So obviously, there's a lot of reason for people to be unhappy with the environment.
Yeah, I would want to just come back on something Tim said early on. I happen to think that one of the most important decisions President Obama did was picking Tim as Treasury Secretary, because the policy continuity was amazing, and then picking Ben for a second term. Those were very, very consequential decisions and made a big difference. Now, in terms of the economy, you know, one of the very first speeches I made as Treasury Secretary in July of 2006, mm-hmm. I think maybe surprised some people on the White House staff when I talked about income disparity. Hmm. One of the things that I'm thinking about a lot these days is, you know, that we have this economy that's growing at a fast rate, 2.5% to maybe 3%, increasing all kinds of jobs, but it's not going to work for our democracy, if we continue to have dysfunction in Washington and we don't figure out how to make this growth work for more Americans. Too many people are being left behind. You look at these structural changes that are going on, some of which are getting blamed on the crisis, when actually they were predated the crisis, mm-hmm. and they are contributors to the crisis. When you look at automation and the impact on wages that's coming from that. When you look at the changing nature of work in America, by 2020, half of Americans won't be working for companies. They'll be self-employed. And so the policies we had that used to work for this country aren't working as well. And the Americans that know that their political system isn't working for them, that pushes them to push their politicians in political corners. And so to me, the economic issues are the flip side of political issues. And so how to get our economy working for more Americans is the number one question I have.
We are going to air the last little bit of my interview with Tim Geithner, Ben Bernanke, and Hank Paulson tomorrow about the future and the crises yet to come. We've got a transcript of the whole hour online, along with all of our coverage of the crisis and the 10 years since. It's called Divided Decade. You can get it online at marketplace.org or on the Marketplace podcast. Subscribe wherever you like. This final note on the way out today, Fed Chair Jay Powell's answer to the second-to-last question he got this afternoon, which was whether the prospect of raising interest rates going into the 2018 midterms and 2020 presidential election cycles, never a thing politicians want to see, right, rising rates, whether that is keeping him up at night.
No, that doesn't keep me awake at night. We don't consider the election cycle, you know, we're looking very carefully at our assigned responsibilities of maximum employment, stable prices. And that's really our focus. You can count on us to stay focused on the jobs that Congress has assigned us and count on us to use the tools we have to achieve them.
Figured it was important to get that on the record because the current occupant of the White House, you might remember, said in 2016 that the Fed was rigging economic policy against him. Okay, we're done. The Dow Industrials off 44 points today, 0.1%. Should tell you, though, it was up a couple of hundred points at one point during the session. NASDAQ down 19 points, about 0.25%. S&P 500 slipped 5. That is about 0.1%. Sarah Brugger, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostat, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong.
New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.